Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath.
All right, you're going to get to hear the ID one more time, okay, because I was asleep at the switch when I should have cut it off here a few seconds ago. But Neil Puckett joined me yesterday for kind of a liberal arts discussion about his career and about military justice. So we'll do that. It's kind of a preparation for a show we'll do next week about his role in the defense of Staff Sergeant Frank Woodrich as he was charged with nine counts of negligent, first murder, then negligent manslaughter, and then ultimately plea bargain to one count of dereliction of duty. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Neil Puckett, retired Marine and lawyer. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, Neil Puckett joins us, and Puckett, can you tell me who is playing the guitar, not the vocals, but the guitar in this song?
I've never heard the song before, so no, I cannot.
Santana. I thought you'd be maybe, you're old enough, you ought to know him. So anyway, joining me, the pleasure today, Neil Puckett. And for those of you that have paid attention to military justice, you have probably heard his name, you've probably seen his face. And so, first of all, Neil, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Mac. Happy to be here.
All right. We're going to learn about you today, and we're going to have a kind of a liberal arts discussion about military justice, because I go off about it all the time, and so maybe you can explain that which we fail to understand. So as we watch it in the future, we can. I can't tell you how frustrating watching the Marine Corps court-martials in Paris Island, in the Siddiqui case, especially in the area of officer justice. I don't understand it. I've done the same thing relative to the Fitzgerald collision and the McCain collisions, where the officer of the deck of the Fitzgerald received NJP, seven sailors killed that night. And right. When she was at the helm, and I don't get it now. She was later court-martialed. She was later taken to a summary court-martial. We all know that's the lowest level of court-martial. It just seems like head-scratching to me. So you've been brought on today to defend all of that. So I hope you're ready to do that.
Okay.
No, all right. Well, we won't hold you accountable for it, but you're going to be asked to explain it to us anyway.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right, but before we do any of that, we have to find out about you. All right, so that way we can know if we should believe you or not. So, Puckett, first of all, born and raised where?
Born and raised in Indianapolis, Indiana.
All right. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
A really good friend of mine, while we were in high school, told me that he had visited a Marine Corps officer selection officer, and he was telling me about how he was going to go in the Marine Corps. And I looked up to him a great deal, kind of a role model for me, and I decided I wanted to meet this officer selection officer too. So we rolled in there together as high school seniors and said, and asked the guy about the Marine Corps program. He said, well, first of all, you're not eligible yet because you're not in college. So come back and talk to me after you get to college, after your first semester. So I did, and the program that I was specifically interested in was the PLC law program. So the deal was going to be for me, I would go to college and then get commissioned and then defer my active duty as part of the program for 3 years while I got my law degree and then come on active duty as a first lieutenant lawyer and go to the basic school. life had different plans for me. I got married, had a child and another on the way by commissioning time. And so I just went in, as a regular officer looking for an MOS and ended up at the basic school in 1977. And was there, I believe in the same class with, now General Dunford.
I was going to say, before I ask you to tell us if Dunford was a shitbird as a lieutenant, where did you go to college?
I went to college at Indiana University in Bloomington. I had a double major in psychology and speech communication and had already decided in high school that I wanted to go to law school and be a criminal defense lawyer.
Okay, so that's already in your head, and yes. So the Marine Corps pops up. You think that's a good idea, and so you didn't cross paths with Dunford. You know, you can't tell me if he's a shitbird.
I just don't have a recollection.
Well, obviously, underwhelmed by the guy. So you become an intel officer.
I'm sure he remembers me, though.
Exactly. You become a intel officer. Tell me about that. Where'd you go? Where'd you serve? What'd you do?
Well, it was a fun time because it was the first year that they were allowing unrestricted officers to go into that field. You had to cross take into the field from combat arms before that. But so I was in the first class of lieutenants that got to go into that field, and I went to they didn't really have a school, so they sent me out to a Air Force base in Colorado, and I went to the Navy Intelligence Officers course and learned how to be a squadron S2 officer, a squadron intelligence officer on a carrier, which wasn't going to be of much use to me. But my first assignment was 2nd Marine Division, and I was stationed with 1st Battalion 8th Marines, which later became BLT 1-8.
All right.
So that as in that role, I was also a platoon commander. I had the surveillance and target acquisition platoon, which included scout snipers and people who ran the seismic intrusion devices and night observation devices and things like that.
Kind of a mini reconnaissance
unit. You know.
Yeah, you bet. Did you enjoy it? Was it what you thought it would be?
I loved it, it was a particularly good experience for me because we got to do a med deployment for 6 months, which, you know, during the Cold War, that was right. As close as you came to combat, usually. And my executive officer was a guy who later became General Anthony Zinni. He was a major, and I was a first lieutenant, and he was within the stateroom across the hall from me, and he's the guy I kind of modeled my Marine officership after.
You know what you're talking about. When I refer to Zinni, I refer to him as the burning bush. He, to me, is what a Marine officer ought to be, not only in execution but also later on in life in dissent. One of the lone voices that you heard loudly before the war in Iraq was Tony Zinni saying that you don't need to do this, saying I'm not sure what planet they're on. Essentially taking the Secretary of Defense to task for it. And he was not afraid to speak the truth. And I think we have sometimes a bit of a crisis in general officers in that they don't like swimming upstream. And Zinni believes in the truth, and he's not afraid. And so what was he like as a battalion XO?
Well, he was kind of youthful and vigorous and always with the humor, always with the teaching moments, and had nothing but a benevolent attitude towards we junior officers as we were trying to learn our trade. Just tremendous respect for him.
Let me ask you a question about being an officer in the late 70s. Not the easiest time in the Marine Corps. Obviously, the Marine Corps comes back from Vietnam, and then we have the program to essentially get the drug guys out of the Marine Corps, get the racists out of the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps begins to rebuild itself. The Marine Corps that you joined, what was it like?
Well, I didn't see a lot of that. We had a really good unit with 1-8, throughout the deployment and so forth. I didn't see any racial divides or any racial concerns at all. They may have been there, but they weren't on my radar. So although we were generally aware of it, it didn't seem to personally impact me. Perhaps if I had been an African American Marine, I might have felt differently about that. But it just wasn't wasn't on our radar.
All right. No, it's an interesting time in Marine Corps history. And as you say, as you talked about, you had guys like him navigating that, guys like Butch Neal, guys that will come on, that will go on to have incredible careers. But certainly interesting guys you got to cross paths. Tell me about the going funded law. You have this law thing in the back of your head, but it's a competitive program. How did you swing that?
Well, the first thing that happened to me was I got recruited into counterintelligence. And so the Marine Corps was organized differently back then. We had counterintelligence teams. So I became as a first lieutenant, I became a counterintelligence team commander working with a bunch of warrant officers and LDOs. And learned a lot from those guys, mostly how to wear your cover a little bit more salty than the Marine Corps regulations require. But that was a fun time. But it was while I was there that I applied for the funded law program. And I think 9 officers were selected that year, and I was fortunate enough to be selected to go do what I had always wanted to do at Marine Corps expense, which was get a law degree and then practice law. So I spent 3 years going back to Indiana University in Bloomington as an active duty first lieutenant and then captain. I got promoted to captain while I was there, meaning I had full pay and allowances, and they were paying all of my tuition and some of my books. So I was living pretty high, but of course then I had 2 children and my wife and I lived in a nice place in Bloomington, and those were some good years, really good years. I was just so blessed to have been selected.
Yeah, you started early with a family. Yeah, so you were.
Yeah, I was 19.
Nice, well done. Well done. Now, was that all planned out? Did you plan to, let's have kids early and we'll go from there?
No. No. None of that was planned. You can't plan your life.
And you have one, and you think this is such a good deal. Let's have another one.
Well, we think we want to have another one, but we know that by the time we have our second child, she's going to be born while I'm on active duty, and she was born at the Quantico Naval Hospital, which no longer exists. It's the old one.
The old one, yeah, down in Q-Town, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So we knew we wanted 2 children, so we just went ahead since I was going to be making the princely sum of $14,400 a year.
Exactly.
Which was more money than I had ever made as a second lieutenant, and have all this respect and admiration, and it's just going to be marvelous, and so we just made it that way.
All right. So take us through funded law. You go to funded law.
And spend the 2 summers between my in between the 3 years, the 2 summers you go TAD to a base. I think the first summer I went to Cherry Point, the second summer I went to Camp Lejeune and helped the legal offices there. Then I graduate in 1984 and go to the Naval Justice School where I get certified as a Marine Corps Judge Advocate. And that was in Newport, Rhode Island. And then that same summer out to Camp Pendleton, where I started my first tour as a lawyer at Camp Pendleton, starting as a defense counsel.
How long did you do that?
Well, I was a defense counsel for 1 year, and then I was recruited by a colonel to come be his deputy staff judge advocate for 1st Marine Division for 1 year, and then for another 2 years after that, I was a prosecutor at Camp Pendleton. So I did 4 years in the courtroom. Just right out of law school, which was basically unparalleled for my peers in law school. Nobody gets to try their own cases in the civilian world. Right out of law school.
So what happens? How long do you stay in the Marine Corps as an SJA, and what do you do, and how does your career unfold from there?
Well, so as a deputy SJA, I assisted the SJA in providing legal advice to the commanding general, and reviewed investigations and reviewed things like that. But the best time, of course, was my time in the courtroom, both as a defense counsel and as a prosecutor. Lots of cases, lots of experience, lots of real world stuff. And again, in those days, before even the first Gulf War, it was an old Marine lawyer who used to kind of chastised the grunts who came in there saying, hey, you know, what we do in here is real. What you guys do is go out and run around in the field with your rifles. But we impact lives forever and with what we do here in the courtroom. And, of course, that all changes in wartime. that was a good time. But then I was once again blessed to have been selected to go on another legal education program that got me a master of laws degree in criminal law. And that was at the University of San Diego Law School. So I got to stay at Camp Pendleton for another year in housing there and get a second law degree. And the payback for that was 3 years as a military judge in Okinawa.
That's my alma mater, by the way, undergrad.
USD?
USD.
Yeah.
One of the prettiest campuses on the West Coast.
It is. My son decided to go there for college as well. He graduated from USD.
Well, that's not good for you, but I'm not sure how you paid for it.
No, it wasn't good for me.
it wasn't that way when I went there in 1978. It was a little bit more affordable.
Yeah.
But now it's, it's pretty, it's not the easiest place to send a kid to go to school. So you go back now, now you're a judge. And do you retire out of the Marine Corps, Neil, or do you leave, or what do you do?
Oh, no. So I spent 3 years in Okinawa trying just a ton of cases. It was a remarkable experience. And then I got a call telling me that I'd been selected for school again, which to me was just crazy. And they said, well, we're gonna send you to Charlottesville, which was the Army Judge Advocate General School, and get another law degree, a master's in military law. And I said, well, wait a minute, are you not reading my record? Do you know I already have two law degrees paid for by the Marine Corps? What do you think the taxpayers are going to say about that? So they rethought it, called me back 24 hours later, and said, well, we swapped you out with somebody else, so you're going to go to the Naval War College, to the College of Naval Command and Staff. So it's been a year at the Naval War College, getting a master's in, what's it called? National Security and Strategic Studies. And then the next assignment for me was going back to be a military judge, but this time at 29 Palms, California. So I went out to the desert and spent 2 years there, trying cases for the Marine Corps. And then, my final assignment was back to Okinawa to be the officer in charge of the Legal Service Support Section, which is the legal office there. And I spent a little under 2 years, before I retired from Okinawa.
And
in 1997.
When were you out in 29 Palms?
I was in 29 Palms from 93 to 95.
We were there at the same time. We're battle buddies.
Oh, really? Where were you?
I was with 3rd Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Bob Neller. And
I've heard that name.
Yeah. And I have a daughter that was born out in the hospital in 29 Palms. So, awesome. So after that, Neil, obviously you've had a pretty varied legal, background in the Marine Corps. What do you decide to do when you get out of the Marine Corps?
Well, I retired to Pensacola, and at Pensacola, I got a job as an assistant federal public defender, trying federal cases in downtown Pensacola in the federal courthouse. I courted, and married, my current wife, who was in the Air Force at the time. She was a squadron commander, of a Navy squadron, actually as an Air Force officer down there, squadron commander of VT-10 NFO training squadron. She got orders to D.C., so we moved to D.C., and I thought I could transfer in the federal public defender system, but there wasn't such a thing at the time, so I decided to take a sabbatical from the law, and I worked for 8 months at the local Starbucks making coffee.
Really?
And I had, I had grown a beard. Shortly after I retired, I stopped cutting my hair and stopped shaving my face, and I'd grown a beard and I had really long hair. I was the long-haired, bearded guy at Starbucks.
You were that guy. You were just undercover though. Beneath all of that,
I was.
You're an uptight Marine. We know.
Right. But it was good. What I did during that time was I wrote a business plan to start my own law practice, a solo law practice. And of course, I got a lot of experience learning about small business operations. I took all this training Starbucks would give me and all that, certainly customer service.
Yeah.
And I learned how to make really good coffee, and now I have a really expensive espresso machine. And a,
do you? Do you know how to work? Could you still remember how to work it and all that?
I work it every morning.
Nice. All right. So you were good. So somebody, I don't drink coffee, so I've missed that whole coffee revolution. But if somebody walked in and gave you their hoity-doity coffee order, you would know how to crush that?
I would absolutely know how to do it.
Nice. You know what? The things you find out. Who knew?
Barista.
It just
came to mind. I don't always list it on my resume, but it's there. So then by early 1999, I was able to put together my business, basically, and I started my solo law practice in military criminal defense in early 1999. I want to say March of 1999. And business just kind of grew very gradually, and I started, lived in Northern Virginia. I did cases at Quantico. I gradually went down to Camp Lejeune, worked in some cases at Camp Pendleton. A lot of Marines would call me. I would get calls from other services, but this was before the Internet was really a big thing. Internet advertising was really a big thing, and I had ads in Navy Times, Marine Corps Times, all the Times newspapers, but that was very expensive and not a lot of return on investment. But things went well for me. My wife got orders out to Omaha, Nebraska, where we spent 3 years. She had 06 command out there. She commanded a flying group of reconnaissance aircraft that fly out of Offutt. And I ran my practice from out there for a while, and that's where my first really big case. Did a lot of fun stuff, did a lot of travel, did a lot of, lots of Okinawa, did a lot of cases in Germany, a lot of cases in England, and throughout the country. But the one that really put my face on TV and got me kind of on the map was, I got a call from, then Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Alan West, later went on to become a congressman, a one-term congressman from Florida. Still relatively active in politics, but he was famous for being a conservative Republican African American veteran, and that was unusual for the South. He represented Florida, and so he made a kind of a big name for himself. And because of the circumstances of his case, where he was accused of abusing a detainee, it got national media coverage, and I was on TV quite a bit. Jesse Ventura he had a television show on MSNBC back in the day. He flew me up to Minneapolis, and we did a show there, and I did all the major news networks, and that case came out very well for my client, and he went on to do good things. And so while I was there, I went back to the Middle East to represent another soldier, and another client heard I was there, Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who was in charge of Abu Ghraib. I consulted with her, and she hired me to represent her. And that of course, was a famous case, as you recall.
A little bit.
Was on TV a lot. Got to go on Good Morning America with that one, and several of the morning talk shows or TV shows, the wake-up shows in New York. And so by that time, I was getting lots of calls and lots of business and getting kind of more and more interesting cases. And by the time I, by a few years later, I was doing, not exclusively, but a lot of what you would kind of loosely call war crimes cases or allegations of kind of misconduct in combat. So it was probably that hubbub that got Cesar Woodridge then pointed in my direction, and he was of course the central character in the Haditha cases.
All right. So what I'd like to talk to you about is military justice. Can we talk in very broad terms? Because as I said, I didn't know that you were affiliated with General Karpinski, because she's one of the examples that I think I mentioned probably yesterday when you and I were talking, but I don't understand it. I don't understand military justice. To me, I understand there's a justice component, but there's also a good order and discipline component to it. And these cases have to send messages to leaders throughout the Department of Defense and the United States military to know that you are going to be held accountable. But what I see, if you ask me, I would tell you, yeah, not so much I'm being held accountable. We don't do that. And so I'm curious, explain in the very broadest sense the UCMJ. What's its purpose in theory? And then I'd be curious about, if you want to editorialize, how does that actually work?
Well, that's a really good question, and that really is the threshold question if you're going to start talking about this topic. And the way I explain it is, it's not really a justice system, it's a disciplinary system. But it's a disciplinary system that has evolved over time and had layered on top of it a lot more constitutional concepts, protections, and processes than it had, let's just say, 200 years ago. So as far back as we can remember, military members have been held accountable for misbehavior, both before the enemy and not, in order to ensure good order and discipline. And the military justice system was Congress's, the UCMJ was Congress's way of providing a criminal code, among other things, a criminal code and a procedural code applicable to the military in order to try to make it more fair and uniform is the key. They're uniform across the services and consistent throughout the service. Now, I think that probably what you're having issues with or have had issues with is the consistency component, because at the same time that it's designed to provide kind of the same rights and remedies for you know, across all the services and across all service members, it's also been designed to be flexible and discretionary in terms of what punishments are adjudicated and what punishments are approved and what punishments are not. So so what happens is you can have the same offense committed with roughly the same facts and circumstances in one service, get very harsh punishment, and in another service get not very much punishment at all, depending on the vagaries or the judgment of the convening authority. And the convening authority is the commanding officer and or commanding general or flag officer commander who orders that someone's charges be tried by a jury or judge in a courtroom.
Okay.
And he or she thereafter approves or disapproves of it.
Okay. So convening authority deals with court martial. Explain non-judicial punishment. The non-judicial punishment authority is resident inside commanders at all levels, or at what levels?
So non-judicial punishment is also part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and it is the authority to administratively punish service members by commanding officers of particular units. That practice varies by service, but a unit commander or a billet, shall we say, a billet for a particular command has to be authorized by the secretary or by the service to have that NJP authority. So it's not a process, or it's not a product of rank, it's a product of position. And in the Marine Corps, it's the company commanders and above, company commanders, battalion commanders, squadron commanders, have that non-judicial punishment authority.
Got it. All right, talk to me about the, as I've had it explained to me in the past, there's a justice component that means you should be treated fairly relative to facts, relative to disclosure and all those things.
We call that due process.
Okay.
So the disciplinary system with due process added to it, meaning that things are deliberative, things are fair, things are even-handed, things are open and above board, and rights are respected. That's what you call due process.
don't pay attention. That's the criminal element of my home. He will pay for it as soon as I get off the air. And then there's the good order and discipline component. What do you call that as a lawyer?
That would be a purpose as a lawyer. We would call that one of the purposes of, or one of the goals of, the process. And that is we put a service member through this process.
Right.
Both in order to properly address and the misconduct alleged and hold that person accountable, but we also do it in a larger sense so that those in his or her unit or larger organization are supposed to be able to find out about the results of that and see it as a deterrent to their inclinations, if they have them, to break the law.
All right. And what do you guys have a name for that, or?
Yeah, that's called general deterrence. Specific deterrence has to do with the offender, him or herself. So you specifically deter that person by punishing them, keeping them from doing it again, and sometimes that's by throwing them out of the service. And general deterrence is to the extent the public knows about what happens to people who are held accountable, it's supposed to be an inhibiting factor for other offense committing.
Okay. If I were to be a critic of the of our disciplinary system, I would tell you that that we seem to skew more towards the due process and specific deterrence, and we're not so much on the general deterrence anymore. Because what I see, and I would use Paris Island, the case of the battalion commander, a gunnery sergeant, it gets 10 years for hazing that contributes to the suicide of a recruit. The battalion commander, who knew he wasn't supposed to be there and had him in that position anyway, is fined $2,000 for 3 months, and as of this program, the airing of this program, will retire as a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps without being reduced.
Do you know if his result was by virtue of a plea bargain, a plea agreement?
I do not.
Okay. That's a problem, and that's definitely an appearance problem for arguing general deterrence. But it's difficult in the extreme to discuss cases without. Knowing the specific circumstances of each case and the reasons those decisions were made. So you can say, well, I think behavior A is worse than behavior B, but it got less punishment. But that's not taking into consideration what the adjudicating authority, the trier of fact, we say if it was a court martial, be it the judge or a jury, saw and heard. And place over the top of that, if you will, Mac, the notion that as currently enforced, the UCMJ does not provide specific punishments for specific offenses.
Right.
It provides maximum punishments. And so depending on the mood, the attitude of the judge or the jury on that particular day, and the people they pick to be on the jury, the committing authority picked to be on the jury, you can get different outcomes for the exact same facts and the exact same evidence because people just view things in different ways.
Is that a problem for the disciplinary system?
It's a consequence of the disciplinary system. It's not necessarily a problem.
Because the system's under assault in the Senate Armed Service Committee and in the House Armed Service Committee because of some of the outcomes of both non-judicial punishment and court-martials relative to sexual assault and sexual harassment, that our system doesn't work because these commanders have too much discretion, and that there has been ideas floated that we want to have a separate pipeline, a separate set of judges for these offenses. Is that a remedy to a symptom or a byproduct of the discretion that commanders have?
Well, it's a very, Mac, it's a very complex problem. So I spent 2.5 years working for the Navy Judge Advocate General in what's called the Defense Counsel Assistance Program. I was the highly qualified expert for complex and sexual assault litigation. And what that means is I was the senior executive level employee who developed and delivered cutting edge trial advocacy training for Navy Defense Counsel and Marine Corps Defense Counsel worldwide for 2.5 years. And one of the problems when it comes to addressing the bow wave of sexual assault issues and problems and just deciding without sufficient knowledge that the system needs to change because it's not producing consistent and sufficient results. It's what I consider to be a failure to understand that those cases, sexual assault cases, which is what created this movement about wanting to change the UCMJ and changing how we do this.
Right.
They're often very, very, very difficult for prosecutors to prove under the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's because of the introduction of alcohol, of foggy memories, situations that are unclear. And, you know, when you have a judge tells a jury, you know, before you vote to convict, you have to assure yourself beyond a reasonable doubt that all these elements of this offense are true. Sometimes the cases, so you have a situation where someone can be guilty of sexual assault, but the proof just isn't there sufficient to satisfy a jury to convict them. And so when this anti-sexual assault movement or this war on sexual assault movement sees these low conviction rates, they think, well, the system isn't good enough. But the system that they develop still has to have a requirement to prove evidence or to submit evidence and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that let's say a rape was committed. And it's often a very, very hard thing to do. And it's going to be just as hard under any future system. Similarly, since we're on this topic, when they talk about professionalizing the UCMJ and putting in the hands of prosecutors like in the civilian system. You've heard all these arguments.
Yep.
And taking it out of the hands of convening authorities who have no legal degree and so forth. Well, I got to tell you, you know, if you talk to prosecutors, current prosecutors, they'll tell you they would probably prosecute fewer sexual assault cases than convening authorities feel pressured to prosecute, because they know they can assess evidence, they can interview witnesses, they know what cases will succeed and what cases won't with a high degree of certainty. But commanding officers who are interested in keeping their jobs primarily and advancing their careers are currently, and this I'm overgeneralizing here, but currently generally disinclined to refuse to prosecute a case because the political environment is such that they fear punishment if they do that.
Yeah, that doesn't. If we think it's somebody was wronged, and we read the circumstance of the case, our threshold is lower. As non-legal people that are looking that justice be done when somebody under our command has been wronged.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. How do you think that Neil, my guest, very graciously, Neil Puckett, retired Marine, what'd you retire as? Colonel? Lieutenant Colonel?
Lieutenant Colonel. Retired Lieutenant Colonel.
Backbone of the Marine Corps, Lieutenant Colonels. I say that about everybody, just so you know. Whatever your rank is when you come on, Sergeant, backbone of the Marine Corps. I say about myself, Major, backbone of the Marine Corps, except everybody scoffs at that. I'm not exactly sure why. But so do you think there will ever be a separate legal system, a separate legal pipeline for certain cases? Given, I think the blowback is always it undermines good order and discipline, specifically the authority of a commanding officer. Your thoughts on that? Will it ever happen?
Well, it's hard to predict, and really it all comes down to our political process and whether the political will to do that materializes. And it's hard to know at this point in time in our time of uncertainty in our political environment, whether or not the forces who want to make that happen can actually make it happen. I know all the services have aligned against it, have aligned against taking convening authority powers away from convening authorities because they believe that nobody's in a better position to know what level of good order and discipline is required of a unit than its commanding officer.
Right.
But the problem, Mac, is that the arguments for quote unquote professionalizing to a lesser extent civilianizing or making more independent the court martial process would not be that hard a thing to do. It's a relatively easy fix, and so the question comes down to, is the political will there in sufficient numbers to make that happen? My belief is that it will happen. I do think it will happen. I don't think it will happen necessarily very soon, but I think that the numbers of convictions for instance for sexual assault are not going up very rapidly, and so I think the pressure is going to continue to bear down on Capitol Hill to modify the system in a way that makes it more like the federal judiciary, going to sentencing guidelines and judge sentencing instead of court member sentencing, jury sentencing. I don't follow it closely, but my sense of it is that there will come a time, maybe 10 years from now, when they do that, just because of the political power that's been brought to bear behind it.
Describe for me the system. Will it be somebody on active duty who's a judge and these cases are referred to that judge? Or is it something outside of the structure of the United States military?
I think the first cut at it is going to be active duty people are going to be doing it, but they're going to be doing it in a way that ensures that they're totally independent from convening authority. Basically, won't have a role other than determining that a case should go into that process. But then he or she won't have a role after that. That's the easiest way to do it.
So the way that's different is, for instance, if somebody's accused of rape in your command, and you as a convening authority assign me as the special court, should it be a special or is a summary? Summary.
If it's sexual assault, it's going to be a general court martial, likely.
Okay. So if that's the problem, so we're having an issue at the general court martial level. How is that going to change with this professional, a professional that does this more frequently?
Well, that's the point I was trying to make earlier, and I don't think the results are actually going to change, but they're going to eliminate the appearance that commanders who in historically have largely been male are somehow undermining the system to protect other males from bad things happening to them. The good old boy system. So that's been the accusation primarily from victims of sexual assault.
Right.
That was a protective system that was happening. But so jumping back, when it goes out of their control and they say, okay, this should go into the court martial system, it goes into the court martial system, they take no further action. They can no longer be accused of protecting people from punishment because of the powers that they wield. But the ironic consequence, I think, is going to be if prosecutors have the sole discretion based on their legal judgment as to whether or not a case is should go forward to a court martial. I think there are going to be a lot more decisions made not to take cases to a court martial because the evidence just isn't there.
Okay, so if we go down that road, then we create this system, and instead of a 60% conviction rate over the course of 100 trials, we now only have 60 trials, and we have a 50% conviction rate. But everybody's okay with that because there's more credibility in the system? Or because, or
everybody's okay with that because lawyers, based on their legal judgment, their prosecutorial discretion and discretionary judgment, are making the decisions, and nobody's protecting anybody.
Okay, so you get hauled in front of the Senate Armed Service Committee. Kristen Gillibrand looks at you and says, Puckett, we now have 60 convictions. All right? When the Hammerheads were doing it, we had 78 convictions. Tell me what's going on. And so politically, they'll accept your answer that, hey, in our legal, professional legal opinion, based on thresholds of evidence, blah, 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 I am telling you unequivocally that this is where you should be. And she says, okay.
Well, the JAGs of the services will be sitting there, and that's exactly the answer they'll give. She may not be satisfied, but, the clever JAG will say, well, this is the system that you gave us.
Oh, I would tell you, I would counsel that guy, be very careful. It might be better just to sit on that one. I don't want to tell you how to live your life, but the truth doesn't matter in Washington,
right.
D.C. And I think we all get to witness that on a daily basis. All right, Neil Puckett, my guest, retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel, long history in the Marine Corps as a prosecutor, defender, judge, and a legal officer at high levels. We're gonna have you back next week, and we're gonna talk about Haditha. I want to lay out though for people the elements of prosecution, the elements of court martial, because so when they hear these terms, that they'll understand them. Convening authority relative to. Let's talk about Haditha. We can talk about others if you care to. But first of all, what is the convening authority? What are his or her responsibilities, and what is their function as the case goes forward?
Well, the convening authority, which is always a flag officer in a general court martial case, has the authority to order.
Just so everybody knows, what's a flag officer?
Okay, a general in the Marine Corps or an admiral in the Navy, a general in the Air Force, general in the Army.
Okay.
So somebody who wears stars. That person has the authority to direct that a court-martial happen, a court-martial be created, and direct that an individual's case, an accused's case or a defendant's case, be sent to that court-martial. So once he does that, the legal people, the lawyers, the prosecutors, take charge of it and prepare for trial. Defense attorney is assigned to the accused, and they all prepare for this criminal trial. And then after it's over, decisions along the way that have to be made with regard to adding new charges, dropping charges, giving witnesses testimonial immunity, meaning their testimony can't be used against them in the future should they be prosecuted themselves. All those decisions have to be brought by the prosecutors to the convening authority, and the convening authority decides whether or not to do those things. Then after the court-martial's over, the results of the court-martial go back to the convening authority, and the convening authority then decides whether to approve or disapprove the results, either the findings or the sentence. The convening authority can reduce the sentence, make it less severe, can suspend or dismiss part of the some of the charges or the sentence, and in other words, grant clemency, grant the magnanimous and make the sentence lighter than what the court martial directed. Similarly, before the trial happens, an accused can agree to plead guilty to some or all of the charges, and in exchange, the convening authority, they sign a contract, can agree to drop charges or limit the punishment that will be approved after the court martial is over. So it's a great deal of power. It's a great deal of discretion. It's a great deal of authority over the judicial process, and it's an awesome responsibility. And I know commanding officers and commanding generals throughout history have taken that part of their job very, very seriously.
And well, they should, right? People's lives hang in the balance. Who supports that? So you have a commanding general. At a minimum, Brigadier General at a minimum, I think Rear Admiral at a minimum, they have probably commanded at the 06 level, probably commanded at the 05
yes.
level, probably commanded yes. maybe at the 04, not so much, at the 03,
right.
and at the 03. So they are no strangers as they've grown up in this system. But once they become a flag officer, who is supporting them and who is advising them?
Okay, so every person in flag command, general or admiral command, is going to have a legal advisor called a staff judge advocate, and that's usually going to be an 05 or 06, a lieutenant colonel, or a commander or captain in the Navy, who's a lawyer, who's also very, very experienced, who will give advice to the convening authority at every step of the way. All those steps I just described, he'll get advice about what the right thing to do is. And those people, those legal advisors, the staff judge advocate, maintain close coordination and communication with the people doing the prosecution, the prosecutors in the local base legal office. So they're constantly transmitting information back and forth, making requests. For instance, they might request up to the commanding general to approve the hiring of an expert, a medical examiner to examine a body, so forth. And those people have to be paid for sometimes. And so he has supporting him in that responsibility, the staff judge advocate, and anybody who he needs who work in the base legal office.
All right. How involved is the commanding general in the ongoings of the court-martial? I convene it. It's being executed. Am I waiting to see the outcome of it? Because can it be appealed to me? What is my responsibility once I convene a court-martial?
Well, in the normal course of business, that convening authority usually just lets his lawyers do what they need to do until
okay.
he needs to make decisions. That's the way it normally works. He's not actively involved in anything. He can get briefs as often as he wants about the progress of any particular case. But he usually doesn't take an active role. The appeal process you talked about is not really an appeal, but as I mentioned before, once the court-martial finishes its job and presents the results to the convening authority can alter to the benefit of the person who's been convicted any result, any sentence. But he can't make it worse. He can never make it worse. He can only make it better.
All right. Okay, so that's and then inside the legal – Inside the legal officer, the SGA's office, let's talk about a Marine division. Are there prosecutors? Are there defenders? How is legal support provided not only for the prosecution but for the defense as well? Could you explain how the SGA is put together inside of a division?
Yeah, so it's not owned by the SJA. The SJA is just the staff officer who advises the flag officer, the general. There's usually a legal services support section, a legal office somewhere else on the base that houses the OIC, court reporters, a section of prosecutors, and a section of defense counsel. The defense counsel report up a separate chain of command through the Chief Defense Counsel of the Marine Corps. There's a Regional Defense Counsel and a Chief Defense Counsel of the Marine Corps. So they have a separate reporting chain so that they can remain independent of the prosecutors. The prosecutors all report to the officer in charge of the Legal Service Support Section. And so they operate in separate lines of authority.
Are they in the same building normally?
They are almost always in the same building, yes. A lot of times it's upstairs and downstairs. Just depends on the arrangement.
Got it.
Usually right. Some separation involved, or separate wings of the same building.
All right. Unique, I think, to military justice is the unique role that that investigations play for the Marine Corps, NCIS, which everybody has seen on TV now and loves.
Mm-hmm.
What is the relationship between NCIS, the prosecutors, and the defenders?
So NCIS often takes guidance from prosecutors, particularly on individual cases.
Okay.
They sometimes call prosecutors for legal guidance, although they have lawyers who work for NCIS. The defense counsel don't have regular interactions with NCIS agents, although they will whenever they need to on a particular case. So if Special Agent Jones has been the lead agent on a particular case and I represent PFC Smith, I can talk to Special Agent Jones pretty much any time I want about the case, and he should be responsive to my request to chat with him. Of course, I can't abuse that, but that's one of the beauties of the UCMJ and the military justice system is that there's supposed to be very little hiding the ball. Hiding evidence would be improper. Failure to disclose evidence would be a sanctionable offense by a prosecutor. So one of the great things, unlike the civilian system, is that defense attorneys in the military are all the evidence in a case that the prosecutor has access to has to be immediately turned over to the defense lawyer who's representing somebody who's been accused of a crime.
So a defender doesn't need to hire his own investigators. Or does it have his own subset of NCIS investigators? They have access or should have access to everything that the prosecution develops, everything NCIS, it goes to both parties.
Yes to the last thing, but the Navy and the Marine Corps have started, the Navy has hired defense investigators, civilian investigators to work at the defense service offices.
Wow.
And so
why?
And there are well because NCIS has refused and I've seen the paperwork documenting this, has refused to formally make available NCIS agents to a defense case. In other words, I'm a military lawyer, I'm a defense lawyer in the Marine Corps, and I say, well, you know, Judge, I want the NCIS to assign an investigator to me because I want to do my own defense
right.
investigation, interview other witnesses and so forth, collect more information than I was given.
Right.
NCIS would refuse that request. And so there are civilians who do it as individual contractors.
Wow.
And the Navy has hired and placed throughout the Navy defense investigators so that cases can be built by defense counsel.
Interesting. Before that, if you were defending somebody and NCIS said no, because normally the investigators would work for the prosecution, yes?
Right, absolutely.
Right, but in this case, it seems to be an unfair burden for a defendant, a Marine, in my little example, that I've got to go hire my own investigator to discover evidence and that the government has all that available to them. How is that fair? And I'm subject to this. How is that system fair and I'm subject to it?
Well, it's not fair except to the extent sometimes defense counsel can bring a motion before a military judge and request that funds be authorized to hire a private investigator if the case is complicated enough or extensive enough to warrant that. Generally speaking, the system expects defense counsel to kind of find their own facts and find their own witnesses. But if you can lay out that it's a complex case and lots of witnesses need to be interviewed and you need a defense investigator, there is precedent for the military judge directing the Canadian authority to fund that hiring.
Neil Puckett, my guest for the last hour. We're talking and doing a kind of a liberal arts discussion about military justice in preparation for talking about the Haditha case. And for those of you who've listened to other programs I've done relative to Haditha, what we're trying to do is simply move the kaleidoscope around the, be it the investigation, be it the court-martial, and to glean what we can, because I think that the more people can understand young officers, young NCOs, staff NCOs, before they go forward, the more they can understand how important their leadership is, and that murder is still murder, and the line between killing in combat and murder is not as thin as people think. and that you'll be held accountable will make you a better leader. It also helps you return the incredible human capital that we get as Marines back home safely, and so that they can go and pursue their lives without the heavy baggage that you can never jettison should you be involved in something that doesn't go well and that could have been prevented had more people had their heads in the game and been more mature relative to what it actually is when we go forward. What we actually mean when we say clear. When we say clear, we don't mean kill civilians. That is not a visa card. And so we'll get into that next week. But Neil has been gracious enough to join us today to explain some stuff. Let me ask you some, I'm going to ask you some current events questions, and you can give me your lawyer answer that I don't know enough to give you an opinion, Mac. Made no sense to me that the officer of the deck on the Fitzgerald was given non-judicial punishment when her mistakes led to the deaths of 7 sailors. How in God's name could that happen? Now, I will tell you this. Do you know, Neil, what they call that authority that they put over to make sure that the results of the different discipline on each ship was relatively uniform? Do you know what they call that?
No, I don't. Okay. I wasn't in any way involved in any of those decisions. But you know, it's interesting. That harkens back to something we talked about before, and that is, it's difficult to understand when you just hear a result. When you hear what happened at sea, and then you hear a result of a disciplinary action, you don't know what went on and why the Navy decided to do that. I mean, it's pretty easy to say that, well, had that woman done something better, folks might still be alive. It's a much harder thing to say, well, okay, so she didn't. So what level of criminality is that really? You know, was that a negligent dereliction of duty, or was that so reckless that she should have anticipated that the decision she made or failed to make would result in those tragic deaths? There's such a wide spectrum of factors that go into those decisions. I'm not defending them in any way because I don't know those things either. But sometimes things we don't know and can't know, there can be good explanations for inexplicable results.
Okay.
The fact that you don't know the explanation is just because of where we sit. You know?
Okay. I'll accept that kind of. General Karpinski, I've used her example before in talking about this issue. You and I both learned, and I'll never forget when I learned it, at Officer Candidate School, this. You're responsible for everything your unit does and fails to do. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm okay with everything my unit does. Everything it fails to do, I'm responsible for that. Like, that's a little broad, in my opinion. Like, is there any way we can, like, narrow that down and make it a little bit more reasonable for old Second Lieutenant McNamara here?
Well, there is a way, and the way I've narrowed it down in the past is you may be held accountable for the things that you are, you know, responsible may not be the right word. You can, in our system, be held accountable for the things your unit does or fails to do. But whether or not you can be held criminally responsible is a completely different universe.
Okay, explain the difference. Explain the two two galaxies of accountable and then criminally responsible. What's the difference?
Okay. Criminally responsible involves two things. Something was done that was wrong, and it was done with loosely what we call criminal intent. So you meant to do it, and you knew it was wrong, and you did it. So that's a criminal offense. That doesn't apply in the standard failure of command case that you talked about. If your unit fails to achieve some mission, that doesn't become a criminal offense. It's not even necessarily even dereliction of duty. It's just something that you failed to do. So your boss, your military boss, can hold you accountable for failing to complete the mission or failing to accomplish the mission.
Right.
But he's unlikely going to be able to hold you criminally responsible and you know, involving criminal punishment and so forth. So I think the more accurate word is accountable. I'm accountable for everything my unit does or fails to do. It goes into individual facts of the situation to describe whether or not there was anything that could have been done about it. And to the extent that your accountability should involve drastic punishment or not, that's where that calculation comes in.
I don't know. I just in the case of General Karpinski, you know, isn't it her job to know what's going on in that facility? Isn't it her job to inspect that? Isn't it her job to ensure that what is going on there is right? And so when it does go south, how are you absolved of that of that responsibility? And the fact that you didn't know, in my opinion, this is might be Mac being a grunt and not smart enough, but I remember the one question court martial. Were you in charge on, you know, December 7th, 1941? Yes. That's all. Thank you. You're free to step down. Because your responsibility is absolute, and why you didn't know and all that, I don't care. But for the sake of good order and discipline, right? You're going to get smoked here. Sorry.
Yeah. So let me lay it out for you very simply. So okay. In the case of Abu Ghraib, the offenders were reservist military policemen whose parent unit was commanded by Brigadier General Karpinski. She retired as a colonel, by the way. She lost a pay grade in retirement.
Then you know what? I should accept her from this discussion because I did not know that. I thought she did retire as a brigadier general, and that she was because of it.
No, they stripped her of her star. But I wanted to make one very important point that doesn't seem to appear anywhere in print, and that is her soldiers who committed that misconduct were not under her command at the time. They had been chopped to the intelligence brigade commander for duty in the hard site where they kept all the high-value detainees. So at the time that happened, imagine two Marine battalions. One's going on a mission, and they need extra guys. So they borrow, let's say, a squad of guys from one battalion, and they go TAD to the other battalion, and the battalion deploys. So holding the battalion commander in the rear, who is not deployed with those guys, responsible for their daily proficiency in conduct and good order and discipline, is not fair. But that's what happened at Abu Ghraib.
So
she owned.
She owned all the
prisons except the one where the misbehavior occurred, and she did not own at that time any of the people who engaged in the behavior.
So then, why was her star taken away?
Because she was a reservist. The intelligence brigade commander was an active duty guy. They did belong to her parent unit. And that was an administrative action that the president took, President Bush took, and which he had the authority to do. We talked earlier about the discretion of authority, and that was just what he chose to do. She was the, I'm not going to call her a scapegoat, that's not accurate. I mean, because you could always say, well, they should have been trained better, you know,
but once they chop to somebody else, they're under somebody else's command, then they're not her issue. And then it's somebody, the sixth step in troop leading, which is supervision, inspecting, knowing what's going on, belongs to somebody else. What happened to the active What happened to the active duty officer?
The active duty officers all in that chain of command were all disciplined at various levels.
Were any of them
a couple of them faced court martial?
Were any of them reduced?
I didn't keep track.
All right. All right, just to tease next week, one of the things that I just finished watching House 2, and And I've also, I had Adam Linehan on, who wrote an article about the documentary, House 2, which is about Haditha. And so just in as a tease, why you should listen next week, Neil, talk about how did ultimately you meet Sergeant Woodridge at the time, and so we're gonna walk through kind of Neil's his experience from the time he was initially hired and came in contact to the ultimate adjudication in early of 2012. So when you talk about this case, why do you tell people that they should pay attention to it? Why is it important, in particular for Marines, to pay attention to it and to learn from it?
Mac, it's important on several levels. One level is I think it's important that Marines understand the truth of what happened at Haditha, because the truth never came out as a result of the court-martial, because there was a plea bargain. So the facts that should have been made public were never made public by anyone until this film came out. So any preconceived notions you may have about what happened at Haditha, you should put those aside. And we can talk about some of the things that are the truth. The film isn't public yet. Right. You got an opportunity to see it, and it can't be made public yet. But we can talk about it. The other reason is to really take a look at the military justice system and see how it's. To talk about its strengths and its weaknesses, and seeing how its weaknesses were either intentionally or unintentionally exploited to end up with a situation where the folks who should have been held accountable were not. So it's two levels, basically. It's the operator level and it's the military justice level. Mistakes made, lessons can be learned, and desires is that once people are able to see this, we have a discussion, perhaps even on Capitol Hill, about how we prevent a travesty of the process, of the investigative process and the prosecutorial process, prevent this travesty from happening again in a similar situation.
When you think about everything that you had a bird's eye view of all of this. One of the things you hear when you hear about general court martial for incidents that happen during combat is they're making this guy a scapegoat. They're scapegoating this guy. I'm curious about your thoughts on that, because I've heard it apply to people that I thought were straight up guilty as guilty can be of murder. And you come home and you turn on the radio or turn on the television and you're listening to some jackass who really doesn't understand, the nature of the conflict, hasn't read too much other than what their producer provided them about this bit that they're going to try to get to the top of the click list. Today on their broadcasting company's website. I'm curious about your thoughts about the idea of scapegoating after your experience.
Well, the word scapegoat is overused and misused and used to spin a circumstance to someone's favor usually. So it's usually there are very rare cases of scapegoating. You know, holding someone accountable who is accountable is not scapegoating.
Right.
Holding only one person accountable when you could have held other people accountable as well, again, it's not purely scapegoating, because to the extent that that person is should have been held accountable, they're not a scapegoat. But in a situation where when a process is driven by some kind of ulterior motive, and I mean there are movies about this and TV shows, where someone is framed. A person who's framed, I think that's the truest version of scapegoating. You know, when someone is falsely accused and false evidence is provided, false credible evidence is provided, that's the most pure form of scapegoating. So I would take with a grain of salt anytime someone said, my client's been scapegoated. Defense attorneys say that all the time, even when they know better, because they're shaping the message and they're spinning it. And if we've learned nothing over the past couple of years since the election about the label of fake news and so forth, we know that we should be very skeptical of anything we just hear or see. Not that it's not true, but we should question, well, what's the source of this? How true can this be? How do they know that? I always ask, how do you know? It's not because I don't trust the person talking to me. It's because I want to know the source of the information so I'm able to consider whether or not to believe it. But scapegoating is an overused and an unreliable label, usually.
Final question, as we tease next week, do you think most people will be surprised as we kind of move through the discussion about Haditha?
I think they'll be extremely surprised. I've heard reactions, everything from disbelief to how can that possibly be, to I wish I would have known that. Because the film, as you saw, presents forensic evidence from forensic scientists that basically blows up the whole Haditha prosecution.
All right. So we'll leave it at that. Trust me, you don't want to miss it. The documentary, as Neil said, is not out yet. It's called House 2. And like all good, good documentaries, it relies on not narrative from a narrator, but it simply relies on the interview footage of, in this case, of Marines, of Marine Councils, of NCIS agents, and lays out what are the facts surrounding what happened that day in Haditha. One more tease, and one of the things that I found most disturbing is the lack of an investigation, and I'd ask you to put on your Marine SJA hat here, by 2nd Marine Division and 2MEF. In my opinion, they fail the institution. They fail to protect the Marine Corps. They fail to protect the Marines by getting at the truth and in order to be able to adjudicate this. I'm curious about your thoughts. Is that still a head scratcher for you to this day? How no investigation would have been ordered by at a minimum the division, let alone the MEF?
It's totally a head scratcher, Mac. Because having grown up as a lawyer in the Marine Corps, I always knew that whenever there was a death, there was going to be a JAG manual investigation, right?
Right.
They have to be investigated. It's mandatory. So when there are 24 confirmed civilian deaths, how does someone in the division, even the battalion commander, how does he not order an immediate inquiry, at least a preliminary inquiry, and maybe a JAG manual investigation, while the evidence is still available, while bullets can be dug out of walls and matched with rifles, and good photographs can be taken? There were photographs, but they were kind of haphazard. How do you not do that, if only in an effort to clear your guys of any accusation that they acted improperly? Don't you have an obligation as a commander at any level, battalion, regiment, division, to protect not only the institution, but also protect individuals involved?
Right.
I said throughout the 6 years that this case went on, I said, had I only had access to the evidence that existed on that day, I would have been able to prove that my client did not shoot any of those civilians. I would have been able to prove that. But because that wasn't done, and NCIS didn't show up until 3 or 4 months later, all that evidence was gone.
It is, it is heads, and I will tell you what, I've spent almost 3 years between Iraq and Afghanistan. I have not taken a breath in my time in either one of those two areas of operation, where 19 civilian deaths, and I'll just say the five in the car were categorized as something else, military age males that closed on us after the IED went off. Okay, there's not a day that I've taken a breath there where 19 does not get your attention. There's not a day that I've ever been there that five doesn't get your attention. So when you look at the failure of the 2nd Marine Division and of 2MEF, it is head shaking, and a lot of this would have been alleviated had they acted rightly. And I've seen statements by people associated with the division, the MEF, saying, no, that wasn't a big deal. Bullshit. I was there the year before when all hell was breaking loose across the province, because I know 2005 wasn't worse than 2004, and I will tell you this: when there were casualties, they got investigated. When there were civilian casualties, and I'll tell you what, it sure as hell didn't take 19 to get Phil Betts out of his office to go do an investigation. So it's just a head scratcher. So Neil, first of all, thank you very much for doing this today, and certainly looking forward to it. And just so everybody listening, I didn't know too much about Haditha, but I've begun to learn about it. It's not the easiest thing to understand, but I think the way we'll lay it out, you'll get a chance to get your hands around it. But most importantly, especially for active duty Marines that are listening to this, you're going to get a chance to hear what happens when you don't do things right. And when you don't, when you miss the mark, and then people get subjected, to our court martial system, and it's not a perfect system. And so it's incredibly important that your Marines are mentally prepared to go to war. And understand killing, and even if you walk through the Haditha thing and in the houses, you can understand if they believed in their heart of hearts that they were taking fire, and they went to clear. You can understand the initial casualties. What you can't understand is somebody not screaming, "Stop! They're all civilians. Stop where you're at," and then the grown-ups getting involved in it, because you can defend that based on what's happened. But some of it is not defensible. So, sir, thank you very much. And, I would absolutely look forward to having you back on. And I hope you don't mind if I call you every once in a while when I have a military, justice question, and not that I have your cell number, you screwed up and gave me that.
I can't take that back.
You could always change it or block me, but I hope you don't mind if I call you, because I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion, Neil.
Happy to do it.
All right, more of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Yeah, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world, leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.